Good morning and welcome to KPCW's Community Voices for the first day of March. And this is Larry Warren along with Pam Wiley joining me this morning. And I guess March is coming in like a lion, bringing us lots of freshy snow. And
nice to have it roar in. That's absolutely terrific.
Yeah. And we're going to have an interesting conversation this morning. Our first guest will be Jack Abramoff. And if you don't know that name, you haven't been paying attention to politics in the last decade. Jack is well-known, infamously known as the Washington lobbyist who became America's most notorious lobbyist. And when he went down on several federal charges, wound up in prison, a couple of congressmen also convicted, and many congressional aides and White House aides, etc., went down when the Abramoff lobbying scandal took place. And we have Jack Abramoff on the phone with us. And then after that, we'll talk to our local politician.
All right. And that will be Dana Williams. He's the mayor of Park City. He's also part of Motherlode Canyon Band. And he's going to be discussing with us his upcoming trip to China, as well as his thoughts on how government should work.
But first, on the line with us now, we have Jack Abramoff. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And you are the author of a new book called Capital Punishment, The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyist. And I must say, you know, most people on their book jackets put down glowing reviews of the author's work. And your book jacket has the following quotes: Jack Abramoff, he's scum. And another one from a senator saying, I wish he'd never been born. From a congressman, he's a creep and we hate him. And a commentator says, the most evil lobbyist ever to be operating in Washington. And another guy saying, this stuff could gag a maggot. So that's quite an endorsement there, Jack.
Well, those were the only positive ones I could find. So I thought it was important to show the level to which the case had sunk in terms of the public discourse. And you know, the publisher asked me to find people who would comment positively about my manuscript. I hadn't actually shown it to anyone, so I thought it'd be more provocative and interesting for readers to see that.
It certainly is, and. So you were considered the most powerful lobbyist in Washington. It all came crashing down. You pled guilty to three counts of fraud, et cetera. What were you guilty of?
Well, I pled guilty to not informing my clients that some of the companies that I recommended to them and worked with to help them, that I was profiting from the profit of those companies. I pled guilty to diverting money that was supposed to be paid to me directly to charities that we supported, as opposed to coming to me and then going to the charities. And I pled guilty to providing members of Congress and their staff with an ongoing series of, frankly, it wasn't called this by law, but it ultimately was just bribes, which were tickets to ball games and meals at restaurants and travel, et cetera, campaign contributions in order to get them to be interested in supporting the things that my clients wanted.
And that's really at the centerpiece of your whole enterprise as a Washington lobbyist, was the whining and dining and contributing to of members of the U.S. Congress and aides in the White House. And I recall you talking on 60 Minutes about the process of buying a congressman or a congressional aide. So let's talk a little bit about that. What made you the most successful lobbyist in Washington? How were you able to wield influence in congressional offices?
Well, I think what made us, the people who worked for me, I had about 40 lobbyists under me over the times, and what made us successful was a combination of things. Number one, a lobbyist has got to get access to the decision makers. In the same way that you don't want to hire a lawyer who can't get you into court, you don't want a lobbyist who can't get to the congressman or staff who are going to make a decision. So we had a tremendous access through these offices, and unfortunately the access we had was derived from giving contributions and raising money. I raised millions of dollars every year for Republicans and Democrats. I had Democrats who worked for me, because you can't be a big lobbying firm without doing both sides in Washington, and providing them with meals and tickets to ball games, et cetera, basically creating social access to them. Then once you have access, what a lobbyist next needs to do is make their case fairly profoundly and succinctly to these decision makers and stay on them politically. And we were able to do that probably all of those parts of the process probably more aggressively than our opponents.
To the point that you at one point bragged that you had over 100 congressional offices that you had essentially bought through not bribery, but it sure looks like bribery, through the tickets to the skyboxes you owned at the stadiums and meals and golf outings to St. Andrews, Scotland, and things like that. So another technique that you talk about is simply offering jobs to people who worked in these offices. And just the mere offer of a job bought you additional access.
Well, first of all, let me say that in terms of the offices that we had influence in, I think the phraseology of bought and owned and rest was more Leslie Stahl when she interviewed me on 60 Minutes, and I didn't disagree. I mean, the truth is we had tremendous and constant influence and access in these offices, both through the provision of tickets and contributions, which, by the way, were in fact bribes. I mean, these are bribes. When you give a public servant something that of monetary value and you're seeking something from that public servant, that's a bribe. I mean, and anybody else except people in Washington know that. But in terms of the other thing you mentioned, I did offer and hired many members. In fact, most of the lobbyists I had came from Capitol Hill. And what I noticed, and I wrote my book and talked about it, was that the minute I offered a job to somebody, if they weren't going to come next week, let's just say they were going to come after a few months or even a couple of years, they would start acting as if they already worked for us. And they would indeed do our bidding. And so, in fact, we had control, in essence, of that office, depending on who that person was.
And it extended beyond Congress to the White House. You also had relationships with a lot of White House aides that came about the same way.
Similar, but a little different. Most of the White House folks, in fact, I can't think of a White House person that we had any dealings with in the administration where they got any gifts or anything like that, because their gift ban rules were much stricter. My relationships with the executive branch were really secondary, by the way, to my congressional relationships, because the fact is most lobbying firms work through the Congress. It's difficult to lobby and work through an administration. Normally, we would be in opposition to administration and use the congressional support to oppose them, such as we did during the Clinton years.
You know, in looking at your book, a lot of what you write in the book seems more like spy versus spy, with one side pulling one shenanigan behind the scenes and then another side pulling a counter shenanigan. It goes back and forth. And it's almost like, you know, I mean, that's just kind of crazy enough. But
that's the political process.
Yes, I know. But it's almost like arms dealers, where neither lobbying side wants any war to end. They want it all to continue in a perpetual motion warfare so they can continue to collect fees.
Yeah, that is actually, I think that is generally the lobbying world. They are perfectly happy for things to keep going. We actually took a different tack during those days. We wanted fights to end because we knew that there would always be another fight, but we didn't think strategically it was right, or frankly, at a moral level, it was right to do that to the clients in terms of keeping fights going for any reason other than, you know, whatever. But we tried to end our fights decisively, but we knew that the clients that we had, unfortunately, were always in trouble and fights. And there was never an end to it.
Well, there was one place where you did play both sides, and that was the anti-gambling interests versus the Indians, right?
Well, actually, it's not accurate completely, Pam. The I did organize the anti-gambling interests on behalf of the Indians. See, the Indians I represented, tribal casinos, they had competition. and they would use us, as would corporations and others, to fight their competition. And what they didn't want these tribes is to have a competitive casino, whether it's Indian or non-Indian, show up and take away their market. So we would employ our political skills and warfare tactics to stop those efforts. But they weren't in contrast or against our clients. They were, in fact, the efforts for our clients. They may have been against other tribes, but, you know, the Indian tribes don't view themselves as one big nation like America. They view themselves more like Europe, where you have sort of French versus German versus Swiss versus Italian, that kind of thing.
Okay, but it looks like, and this is where you organize grassroots efforts, right, for the anti-gambling interests?
Right.
And it looks like you have used that in several places where the people who are being motivated have no idea of the scheming behind what you're doing. I mean, it's all this manipulation thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, the people we organized, the Christian, for the most part, groups that we organized to fight gambling, we had a short-term mutual goal of beating back a new casino. Oftentimes, the people, I didn't directly liaise with those guys, but I liaised with their leaders, and they certainly knew that we were representing the Indian tribes. It wasn't a secret that I was a big representative of Indian tribes. Some of them chose, like Ralph Reed, not to tell their folks who was behind the funding, and later it came back to be fairly embarrassing, but we let them make those decisions. That was not something we were directly involved with.
Now, the a great source of your business was representing Indian casinos, and in fact, two movies have been made about you, and they were both named Casino Jack, with Kevin Spacey playing you in one of them, and the other a straight documentary. Result of that lobbying was a creation of tremendous wealth for you and your firm, and a lot of the restitution you owe is back to Indian tribes in the 20-something million range. And since your conviction, everybody who has studied this says you grossly overcharged Indian tribes for what you delivered for them. And invoices would simply say $2 or $3 million for services rendered, and the tribes paid these bills in most cases, although some tribal councils did rebel. I mean, in good conscience, were you worth that to an Indian tribe?
Well, let me try to correct some inaccuracies, I think, which you may have picked up in some of the press.
Okay.
Because not all of what was reported about me was accurate, believe it or not. About a third was accurate, a third was kind of exaggerated, and a third was just totally made up. But let me try to focus back on this aspect for you. We charged about $80 million, or north of $80 million to our clients. We added up in terms of the benefit, financial benefit, that was the clients benefited either through savings or through certain appropriations, although that was more minuscule comparatively. And what we delivered for our clients was north of $6 billion. Our clients felt that we were absolutely worth it. There was never a tribal council that had hired me that, quote, rebelled. What happened was there were tribal councils that had elections where their opposition came into power, and their opposition hated their predecessors, and we were the golden boys of their predecessors, so they, in fact, let us go, as is normal, and hired other lobbyists. And the accusations that were made against me, some of them in terms of this grossly overcharging my clients, I think that there's not one of my actual clients who paid the bills, who saw the benefits that we provided to them, again, which was in the billions, that would agree with that. And indeed, some of my clients even showed up to the sentencing hearing and other places to try to get this out. But what happened was my story, because I sat quietly, I didn't defend myself, the media got to run wild and accused me of everything. My goodness, I was actually accused by some of the media down in Louisiana of having been responsible for Hurricane Katrina. And so things just sort of went out of control. But in terms of the clients, you know, we served our clients very faithfully. We served our clients very effectively. We only lost one time over 10 years for our clients. But, you know, again, that was another world. I mean, we're talking about the old days, and I frankly regret I was in that world. But I try at least to keep people accurate as to what happened, not to enable the kind of hyperbole of the press to take over. But the important thing now is my efforts, I hope, to do something about that world and do something about the uneven influence that lobbyists like I had as opposed to the average citizen in Washington.
I'd like to speak about that. Now, Earl M. Jorgensen was a client of mine, and of the 80 or so organizations I've been involved with, his business was at the top as far as honesty and enthusiasm and treatment of employees. And he lived the American dream, coming from Norway when he was young, and he wanted everybody else to be able to live it. And as you know, Earl was on President Reagan's kitchen cabinet of trusted friends. And I think Earl would be aghast at the unholy alliance of dishonest lobbying interests in Congress, and he would be ashamed especially of the alliance of corrupt business interests in Congress. And I think Reagan would feel the same. What should be done to stop this alliance?
Well, I think, first of all, Pam, you're right, and everybody should be ashamed and upset about it, not just President Reagan, may he rest in peace, and Mr. Jorgensen. The fact is, it's a very big problem, and I think the way to stop a lot of this is to get the special interest money and the lobbyist money out of the process. The ability to raise contributions, again, I raise millions a year, but lobbyists are doing the same even as we talk on the phone. People are basically out there doing the same stuff, having money influence and tilt the playing field in a way that people would find inappropriate. So we need to remove the money that lobbyists and special interests are putting into federal politics. Number two, we need to shut the revolving door between public service and the influence industry. I think we also need to give these guys some term limits so they don't stay there forever, because corruption, frankly, seeps in over time. And finally, the other thing I'm proposing to hopefully happen in the short term is that every law that they make should be applied to them. These are some common sense steps that everybody in the country would support. We got to get them to support.
But Jack, be honest, if you hadn't been caught, wouldn't you still be doing exactly what you were doing?
Yeah, I am honest about it, and I'm ashamed to say, yes, I would be. In a certain respect, you know, I benefited from the fact that my career ended. You know, I probably would have been there. I can't imagine I wouldn't have been there. I didn't see anything wrong with it, and part of the problem is most of the people, in fact, virtually everybody in this system, doesn't see anything wrong with it. It's all normal. It's all dressed up pretty. It's not like people run into offices with sacks of cash and say, okay, Congressman, here's a sack of cash, be my buddy, and vote for me tomorrow. What they do is they walk in suits with envelopes full of campaign contribution checks and politely hand it over and have the same conversation. And so, unfortunately, it's an atmosphere that's bad. Now, it doesn't excuse my particular behavior, and I'm not trying to give an excuse of, gee, everybody's doing it. Everybody, to some level, is doing it. That doesn't excuse me. I was doing it 100% more, let's just say. But we got to do something about the overall atmosphere. We got to do something about the rules, and here's at least, I think, some ways to start. It's a constant battle. I work now with reform groups. I'm a senior fellow at United Republic, which is one of them, and I try to remind them that this is not going to end with one or two legislative victories. This is going to be a constant war. People like I was are constantly looking for loopholes and ways around things, and it's just going to have to be a constant battle.
Now, you came out here to Utah just last week or maybe the week before and talked with some members of Utah's legislature. So what did you tell them, and what kind of reception did you get? You didn't really end up meeting with too many of them, did you?
Well, there seemed to be a ton of them there. I don't know how big your legislature is.
Okay.
But it seemed to be a very big room full of them when I went early
in
the morning.
Okay, I was misled then.
They were very, very gracious. I spoke about these matters, the importance of not being, as legislators, not being influenced by, or not, frankly, ideally accepting money from special interests and people who have other desires in mind than they should, and also to be mindful of the fact that lobbyists and people who have a special interest and sort of want to use the government process in a way that may not even be appropriate aren't evil people. They shouldn't look for somebody coming in with horns. they're good people. They're normal people, but they're doing things that are probably going to be, at the end of the day, bad for the country and certainly bad for Utah. And just to be mindful of that, and I thought a very nice reception, some good questions, and, you know, we'll see. I mean, we'll see where it goes.
What about the relationship of people running for office and one issue voters? I mean, we have pro-life, patriotism, free enterprise, national defense people, efficient government, people who will say, this is the most important thing. I don't care about anything else. And they are just strung along by people running for office and by lobbyists who are doing grassroots efforts, as you know. And on the other side, there's the pro-labor and the people who say, like Nancy Pelosi did, no, there will be no changes to Social Security and even environmentalists. What about that?
Well, I think it's, you know, this is part of democracy. We've had this our entire time. We used to have parties in the country that were designed and geared around, you know, issues, just single issue parties. This is what happens in a democracy, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's people have an involvement and interest in politics because of one issue. God bless them. I mean, I may or may not agree with them, but that's their right to do it. In terms of people who have more broader issues and looking at everything, that's good too. I mean, my focus is on trying to undo the world I was in and make recompense for what I did, which is unfair tilting of the playing field. People who are, in essence, getting something back from giving, getting something in it to try to get a special cut of the national purse, that kind of thing. That's where my focus is. And I believe, by the way, a lot of the corruption and the frustration will deal with that. Now, it doesn't necessarily deal with the gridlock and things like that, but the truth is the country is severely divided between those who feel that the state should be taking care of, in essence, most, if not all, of our needs, and people should be taxed to pay for that, and those who believe in a free market and low taxes and individual or communal solutions and that kind of thing. And there's a real serious divide here, and so that brings gridlock on some of the big issues. But I think in terms of getting involved politically and being single-issue people, God bless them.
Okay, well, I know that one thing that the Occupy Wall Street movement has in common with the Tea Party and everybody in between is that everybody wants honest government. And if we don't have that, we don't have any place to go.
Exactly. I think the left and the right can agree and do agree. I mean, the reform groups I'm on the right, but the reform groups that I'm working with are on the left, and we do agree on these basic things, that the special interest money and getting congressmen from and staff from making that trip through the revolving door and applying the laws to everybody, those are the things that we can agree on, and we should do something about them together. And then the other things we'll have to just agree to disagree and let the best folks win.
Okay, now last week you mentioned a pledge that people should take if they're running for office.
I'm sorry, Pam, I didn't hear the pledge.
Last week you mentioned a pledge that people should make if they're running for office.
Yes, what I believe is, and what I'm counseling the reform groups, is that we need to come up with definitive language to implement serious reforms along the lines of what we've talked about today. And once we have specific language to solicit pledges from those on the left and those on the right to sponsor these bills, to make sure that these bills do not get amended and make sure they get supported and voted on, and that those pledges should be to the voters of their district, and in fact, they should sign a pledge that if they don't co-sponsor it within 30 days and they don't support it along the way at every juncture, they should not run again for office. And if they do, their opponents hopefully are handed a fairly important sword to go get them.
Now, going back to other reforms, don't all these reforms have to be passed by the people who benefit from this system?
They do, and that's why I think a pledge is important. It's going to probably take a couple cycles. And the people who are serious about reform have got to go in there and beat those who break their pledge. These members of Congress really only understand one thing, which is losing their job. And if they're shown that they will lose their job if they don't vote out these Percocets that they benefit from, that's the only hope we have to get something like this done. Otherwise, they'll keep perverting it and twisting it and getting it to be meaningless. And I think that, look, I understand this process. I worked this process. I did everything that they can think of and worse while I was there. So I get every trick. And at this point, I'm on the other side, and I'm trying to make sure we don't let them use the tricks to undo what this is.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, yeah. Now you've spent three some years in prison. Many of your associates also went to prison, or at least lost their careers, and now you're out. You've written a book. You want to make speeches, and are making speeches about this. What is life like today for Jack Abramoff? Do people return your calls? I'm sure they did. They did quickly before, but do they now? And you must have with income of, you know, $20 million or more a year personally, you must have lived rather well. So what has happened post prison in your life?
Well, first let me say that my wife and I gave away to charity and community causes 80% of what I made. So we live fine. We're living, you know, not quite the same, but don't forget I lived for almost 4 years in a prison. So anything on the outside is better than life in there. And, you know, you take what you get and you make the best of it and you appreciate and thank God for what you have. And that's what I try to do and my family tries to do every day. What I'm doing now is I'm trying to use the knowledge I have and the platform that I'm given by an interested media to hear, you know, what this kind of rogue from the past has to say now, and use that platform to maybe get something good done, which is promoting this kind of reform.
Okay, you're breaking, Jack, you're breaking up.
Nobody else can, because anybody who's like I was is still in there, as I would have been, making the money, and everybody else, unfortunately, was excluded from those doors that get shut where the deals get made that I write about in the book. And I think the key for me is to do everything I can do. I want to be as useful as I can. At some point, if I find I can't be helpful anymore, then, you know, I'll move on and try to do something else.
Now, part of your sentence was restitution in the amount of $25 million, mostly to the Indian tribes. How are you going to make $25 million in the next for the rest of your career?
Well, it's actually worse than that. It's actually $44
million. Oh.
And it's actually a little less than half to the tribes, but... you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'll hit the lottery if I decide to start playing the lottery. I don't know. You know, I just got to take it day by day. I'm going to try to earn as much as I can. I'm very serious about the restitution. Every speech I give and book I sell and everything I do goes to that. You know, I'm just have to do my best and see where life leads me. I take life one day at a time at this point.
Well, and after the best. You called prison a house of pain.
Yes.
And nice to be out, isn't it?
It sure is.
Talk a little bit about prison life. What was it like to go from the life you led to be led into those doors?
Well, it really is the most horrible thing you can imagine. You lose your freedom, you lose your family, you lose everything. You're put into a prison. 90% of the folks in there were drug dealers, so they weren't kind of the folks from that I was used to. You know, got along with everybody. You keep your head down, but you have no privacy. You have no quiet time. You have basically little things that we all take for granted, like being able to go to the restroom with any privacy is gone as well. It's just a horrific place where you just do your best to survive. You keep your sense of humor. You try to keep your faith and, you know, friends and family from the outside keep contact and visit. I was fortunate to have a visit every one of the 185 weekends I was there. So I was, you know, I was very blessed in a certain respect that I have the family that I have and the friends I have who stuck by me, most of which were wonderful and stuck by me. And, you know, you just get through it. You know, everybody's got to play the cards that God deals them. And, you know, mine were kind of difficult in those days.
What were some of the surprises in prison?
Some of the surprises?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know that I had any expectations, to be honest with you. So I'm not sure I had real surprises, but I guess what was an eye-opener for me was the amount of people who were there who basically had been there time and time again. They had spent their life in prison. There was no effort to enable these folks to get any kind of job once they got out of them being a drug dealer. And they didn't teach them any skills. They didn't even utilize those of us who wanted to teach. And I did teach in there. I taught typing and speech to the inmates at the beginning. And no effort to help us or to enable anything good to happen. And that, to me, was a little bit unsettling.
Well, yeah. that goes back to lobbying some time ago that got rid of rehabilitation in prisons and just said, no, it's incarceration.
Yeah. Now, prison is viewed as a storage facility, not a rehabilitation facility. And I think the country suffers from that because we have a criminal class that just keeps revolving. The revolving door there is in and out of prison. And it's tragic for them and their families and mainly for the country.
Jack, I read that when you got out of prison, one of your first jobs was being an accountant for a pizza company?
Right. I wasn't the accountant. I don't know how that got out there, but I was I helped with the marketing with that. But it's not a company, a pizza place, a pizza shop in Baltimore owned by a friend of mine.
Okay.
You have any surprises on the book tour?
No. I mean, I guess it's hard to surprise me anymore, Sam. You know, what I've been through, nothing sort of surprises me. I've been grateful for the reception I've gotten everywhere. At the beginning, sometimes people are a little hostile. I'm sort of used to that. But by the time I'm done, I think people believe I'm sincere. I am sincere. And that I'm trying to do something good, you know, at this point in my life to make up whatever way I can for what I was involved in. And I hope and pray that I can.
Well, you know, your book showed that you had a strong need for excitement and living by your wits in your life, and being able to come up with something just on the spur of the moment for Imelda Marcos to stay out of prison showed that you have a genius for coming up with a kind of a club and carrot approach. Are those reflexes still with you? Have you had to change them?
Well, it's hard to change character traits. It's hard to change one character trait. I've done my best to try to get my hyper-aggressive, win-at-all-cost, ethos under control. And, I'm trying constantly to improve myself, to look within and think about why I do and think things and, you know, hope I can, you know, be a better person. That's all I can do.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us, Jack Abramoff. The book is Capital Punishment, and you are at the centerpiece of the biggest lobbying scandal, I guess, in American history, and certainly the biggest scandal in politics since Watergate. So we appreciate your being on with us and sharing some of your thoughts on how and why things went wrong and what needs to change.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jack.